This is Peter Hurley from the Headshot Crew, and you are hanging with Sharky James on the Petapixel Photography Podcast, people!
What the? Use your indoor voice, Peter. Welcome to the Petapixel Photography Podcast, Episode 18. Is portrait photographer as lucrative as fortune says? In this episode, fortuneless portrait photographer is a great job to do from home, especially if you're a parent. National Geographic slashes 9% of its workforce ahead of Fox taking over. Sony rolls out a very welcome firmware update for the A7 II. And Polaroid and GoPro duke it out. We tell you why. All that and more in episode 18 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Thank you so much, Peter, for opening the show. That was awesome, brother. Next time, though, maybe a little bit more enthusiasm. All right, maybe that's not possible. If you want to see Peter's amazing work, head on over to peterhurley.com and check that out. That's PETERHURLEY.com. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here in episode 18 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We appreciate you all so much, and thank you all for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever else you listen to us. Okay, with that, I'm your host, Sharky James. Let's hit it. If you listened to the very first episode of this podcast, you heard my good friend and Sony Artisan Imagery, Paul Giroux, do the very first intro for this podcast. Well, now he's been featured in a story on Fortune.com entitled, "These Five Work-at-Home Careers Are Great for Parents." One of those five careers that they highlighted is portrait photographer, and Paul is the one that they chose to represent that career. That is pretty awesome. Fortune says that the median salary for a portrait photographer these days is $58,359 a year U.S., with a range from $33,000 on up to $97,000 for a more senior-level photography professional. Now, I don't know how much Paul makes. We're close friends, but I would never ask him. But you can bet he's well above that, being the top photographer that he is. Hey, Sony didn't pick him by accident, you know what I'm saying? He is very good at what he does. You gotta check out his work. The article talks about how Paul runs his photography business from his home studio, so he's closer to his family and his kids get to see dad at work and see what it takes to make a successful business run. You know, it's really nice to see the media giving some love to photography for a change. We so often hear about how hard it is to make it as a photographer, and here's a major financial publication talking about portrait photography being one of their top five picks for working from home, especially if you're a parent. If you want to see what Paul does, make sure you check out his photography blog. He's got a lot of great stuff over there. That's at paulfgeroblog.com. PAULFGEROBLOG.com. He's not only a great photographer, he's also a great guy and a dear friend. So what happens when you take one man and you tell six photographers something different about him and ask them to capture his essence? Well, that's what we find out in a video produced by Canon recently, and it is really cool. You know, I give Canon, as well as Nikon, a lot of grief for not innovating with their cameras, and honestly, they really haven't done a whole lot of innovation in recent years. But I'm not going to give them any grief for this video. This was a great idea and a really powerful project. I wish I could show it to you right now, but we're an audio podcast, so you're going to have to check out the show notes to see this video. And it is definitely not one to be missed. It is very, very cool. So these photographers were told that he was a fisherman, an alcoholic, a millionaire, a convict, a lifesaver, and a psychic. What resulted from this was six different portraits of this man, all shot in the same setting, with the photographer's vision of the person they were told that he was. This is what I love about portrait photography. Nail it, and you can create something that tells a story about someone, even if that story isn't actually true. And you can create a photograph of them that'll be cherished by their family members for a long time to come. And I really, really love that about portrait photography. Of this project, Canon says, quote, "A photograph is shaped more by the person behind the camera than by what's in front of it," end quote. They say that this experiment, entitled Decoy, was intended to prove that, end quote, "shift creative thinking behind the lens," end quote. I really love this project. I think it highlights the artistry and craftsmanship in photography very well. You know, I'd love to see Canon expand this project across the globe and see how photographers in different countries bring their unique vision to it. I think that'd be really, really cool. So make sure you hit our show notes for this episode and check it out. I think you're going to be very inspired by it. I tell you, Sony is on fire, as we all know. I probably don't even need to mention it. We just know it. It's kind of a fact these days. But Sony just keeps on rolling out really cool things. And one of those is uncompressed 14-bit RAW via a firmware update that's coming soon for the A7 Mark II. It's going to be out on November 18th, 2015. Joining the A7 S2, the A7 R2, and the RX 1 R2, that's a lot of numbers and letters right there, huh? Has full-frame Sony cameras that can do uncompressed 14-bit RAW. This new feature can be activated within the camera's menu system following the firmware update. I think it's a good time to remind everybody to check the manufacturer's website for your camera to see if they have firmware updates available, because every so many months, they put out new features and often speed things up and improve overall usability via firmware updates. It's like getting new features and getting new functionality and speedier everything via a firmware update. What's really cool about this particular update is it adds phase detection autofocus to the A7 II when shooting with various lenses using an adapter, and it makes the camera's focusing not only faster, but more precise. That is huge. This is big news if you have an A7 II or you're thinking about getting one. And that's all available via a free update. You just can't beat that. So now the A7 II joins the A7 R2 as Sony cameras which can do phase detection AF with non-E-mount glass. Many photographers have raved about how nice it is to use Canon glass, for instance, on their A7 R2 via an adapter. And now you can do the same with the A7 II and have phase detection AF. That is amazing. So if you've got this camera, watch out for that update coming up on November 18, 2015. Free update. Free goodies. Can't beat it. Many photographers aspire to shoot for National Geographic. I know some of them, and they're at the top of their game. But times are tough, and the 127-year-old institution is changing. And many people think that it's a change for the worse. And I'm thinking especially the employees. On November 3rd, 2015, National Geographic Society announced that it was laying off 9% of its 2,000 employees as it prepares to finalize its expanded partnership with Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox. This move represents approximately 180 jobs lost, reportedly the largest in the history of the society. Remember, National Geographic Society goes back to 1888. That is just incredible. That was a long, long time ago. The NPPA, that's the National Press Photographers Association, reports that employees received an email from the Society CEO, Gary Nell, on Monday, November 2nd, 2015, informing them of the, quote, restructuring and transformation, end quote, telling them to check their email to learn if they still had a job there or not. That's a little bit cold. It said in part, quote, please watch your inbox for important information about your employment status tomorrow. End quote. Ouch. Imagine getting that email. Tell me you'd get any sleep the night before. No, not so much. So Tuesday, the 3rd of November 2015 came, and many were laid off while others were offered buyouts. Among those let go were veteran National Geographic photo editor Sherry L. Bruckbacher, who announced it publicly on Twitter, as well as 63-year-old photographer Michael Nick Nichols, who had been with the magazine for nearly 20 years. Nichols has been the magazine's editor-at-large since 2008, and he tells The Guardian that he wasn't surprised nor devastated by the news, and he received a very nice severance package, as well as a contract to complete the 2-year project that he's been working on for the magazine. So luckily, this worked out pretty well for him, but not so much for others. He told them, quote, I was getting ready to retire in January, so for me, this is kind of a gift, but it's a sad day for my friends who are not as ready. I feel for everybody. End quote. While many are blaming Murdoch and Fox for the cuts, a spokeswoman for National Geographic tells the Washington Post that the layoffs were not part of the deal struck with the company, but rather a move to, quote, take care of long-serving employees. End quote. They took care of them, all right. Just not in the way that it's being spun, I think. The magazine's deal with 21st Century Fox gives Fox a 73% ownership of the Society's media properties and is expected to close sometime in mid-November 2015. Like I said, times are tough. People just aren't buying magazines like they once were. Same with newspapers. Half of all photojournalism jobs are gone since the year 2000. That is just amazing. So it's really no surprise that these cuts, not all of which are photography related, of course, are happening. It's just sad, though. Many people are saying that the magazine just isn't going to be the same. Between these cuts and the direction they think it's going to go, they think it's going to be an entirely different magazine. So stay tuned, and we'll see how this all shakes out. Is it obnoxious to think that one actually invented the cube shape? I think it is. Now, this might be a bit of an exaggeration, but follow me here. According to the Wall Street Journal, Polaroid has filed a lawsuit against GoPro, claiming that the company ripped off their cube camera with its GoPro session. On November 3, 2015, CNA Marketing, the current manufacturer of Polaroid-branded cameras, claims that the session, which launched back in July of 2015, violates the patent for the cube, which actually came out in January of 2014. Polaroid was granted a U.S. design patent for a cube-shaped camera back in May of 2015. Okay, this is just silly. A patent for a camera that's in a common shape. Are people actually buying these because they're cube-shaped? That's doubtful. You know, if that's an important purchase criteria for a camera, I don't know, that's just goofy to me. GoPro says in response to this that its patent filings show that the company was working on the cube-shaped session long before CNA filed for and received its cube patent. So once again, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office possibly dropped the ball. In the design patent granted to CNA, it's pretty simple and vague and says, quote, "The ornamental design for a cubic action camera as shown and described," end quote. Now, along with that are seven illustrations showing a cube-shaped camera in the patent. And honestly, it's just a cube-shaped camera. How did they ever get a design patent for that? It's just a shape. Big deal. It has nothing to do with the camera. What does it even matter? Why do they even care about this? What CNA really cares about here, of course, is money. And what they want is the court to order GoPro to stop selling the session and to give them all money earned thus far from selling that GoPro session camera. This is pretty standard in lawsuits of these types, but it's really annoying. I'm not a lawyer, of course, but here's a potential problem. CNA's patent could be overturned should it be decided that it was wrongfully issued to CNA and should have been given to GoPro, if anyone. So they might be barking up the wrong tree here. You never know. They might actually have to pay GoPro because it's GoPro that it looks like came out with this cube-shaped camera design before and it was wrongfully given to CNA. So who knows what's going to go on with this? Obviously, they're going to be settling this in court at some point. And this comes at a bad time for GoPro. They just haven't had it easy of late. We just reported in the last episode that GoPro's Q3 2015 sales were down in the Americas, despite great sales overseas, and that news caused their stock to drop by 16%. Following news of this lawsuit from CNA, GoPro's stock dropped another 2%. You know, they just can't catch a break lately. Triangles. That's what the world wants, by the way. Triangle-shaped action cameras. No, it doesn't. What does it matter what shape the action camera is? You're going to strap it to your helmet or whatever. As long as it attaches, you're going to put it in a case or something and a mount, right? What does it matter what shape it is? Look at the GoPro. Those things are pretty darn huge. So this thing is just completely obnoxious. CNA thinks it owns the cube shape. Good luck with that. Many of us have hundreds, if not thousands of photos of ourselves, thanks to digital cameras and smartphones. In the film days, that number was significantly less. You know, 15, 20 years or so ago, you pretty much knew what every photo of you in it looked like because you didn't have many to remember. Good luck with that now, right? But back in the 1800s, most people would be considered lucky if they had just one photo of themselves. And famous people, as it turned out, had about 100 or so or more. Now, one might guess that the most photographed American of the 19th century would probably be President Abraham Lincoln, but they'd be wrong. It was actually African-American abolitionist, speaker, writer, and statesman Frederick Douglass. That is just amazing. Most people would have guessed an old white guy. Nope. Lincoln had 130 photographs of himself, while Douglass had 160, the latter happening between 1841 and 1895. Now, it could very well have been Abraham Lincoln, But his life was cut short, of course. So who knows? We'll never know how many photos he would have actually ended up with. Now, all of this is according to a book entitled Picturing Frederick Douglass, an Illustrated Biography of the 19th Century's Most Photographed American. What I find really cool is that research for the book found that Douglass used photography to help affect social change by posing for as many portraits as possible in order to combat blackface caricatures of the day and to assert the humanity of African Americans in place of slavery. That is pretty darn cool. He wrote, quote, "The humblest servant girl may now possess a picture of herself such as the wealth of kings could not purchase 50 years ago," end quote. The photos were found by scouring hundreds of libraries, museums, schools, societies, archives, and auction houses in the United States and in Europe, some of the original photos having been previously sold for over $10,000 apiece. If you're interested in this book, you can purchase it from Amazon and elsewhere for about $31 US. It contains the photos with extensive captions, writings, and illustrations, and I'm going to add it to my personal collection because I think I'm really going to enjoy this book. If you've ever seen Google Cardboard, you likely thought it was a joke at first. I mean, I know I did. After all, it looks like a homemade ViewMaster. Do you guys remember those? Those were pretty cool. Well, it's actually a thing. Hard to believe, but it is. And if you're a New York Times subscriber, in this Sunday, November 8th, 2015's edition, you're going to get a free Google Cardboard viewer for experiencing immersive photo and video content. That's cool. Over 1 million units will be included in this Sunday's edition, and another 300,000 will be sent out to the paper's digital subscribers as well. I gotta say, I'm impressed that the Gray Lady, as the New York Times is called, has partnered with Google to do something outside of the box. Wait, wouldn't this be inside the box? Never mind. In case you haven't seen Google Cardboard before, it's a cardboard viewer that lets you use your smartphone as the display and the brains, allowing for a low-cost way to consume virtual reality content. So one, don't use this in the rain because it's cardboard after all. And two, VR has been hyped for decades now and still hasn't taken off. You know, for some reason, people just really haven't connected with it. I wonder how many of these 1.3 million viewers that they send out will actually get used. Hopefully people will hold on to them at least. Even if they're just going to check it out once and toss it. Might be cool to try out. So this is part of a new project called NYT VR, a collaboration between The Times and Google. And this isn't a one-off gimmick either. They're planning additional content. So if you get one of these, maybe hang on to it. The first piece of VR content will be a 360-degree film entitled The Displaced, which will, quote, "capture the resilience of three extraordinary children uprooted by war," end quote. Now, The Times says that there's going to be another documentary film coming sometime in December 2015, with more content being available in the future for users to experience with these viewers. NYT VR will soon be releasing an official app for Android and iOS on November 5th, 2015, and those who receive Google Cardboard will, of course, be able to use it to experience VR photos and videos from other services and publications, as well as being able to view 360-degree photos of the world through Google Street View. That's pretty cool stuff. You know, we've all seen those huge virtual reality headsets that you have to strap on your face, which people don't really seem to want to use, and they're often crazy expensive. But Google Cardboard is incredibly cheap, and if they wanted to, Google could get these in the hands of pretty much everyone. They've got that kind of money. And that would probably kill off the VR headset market, because those things are really expensive. And why have one of those if you could use your smartphone and this little cardboard box thing? And if you get yours wet, I'm thinking it's no big deal. You could probably get another one from Google for fairly cheap.
Thanks for the podcast, and greetings from Poland. Dzięki za podcast. Pozdrowienia z Polski.
Thank you so much for the kind words, Matthew. I really appreciate it. Today's listener question comes from Thomas, who recorded his question via our voicemail widget.
Hey, Sharky. My name's Tom, and I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, and I have a question about shooting JPEG versus RAW. Now, I'm not a professional photographer. I only shoot pictures for fun and so that my wife has some stuff to print and put on the wall. I like to share my photos on Flickr and Facebook. And I know both of those sites store and show the images in JPEG format. Now, I've read many, many times that RAW is the way to go. But I use the photo app that Apple makes for my MacBook to do all my organizing and editing. I just find Lightroom to be way too complex and confusing for me. I'm really lazy when it comes to my photo editing. I like to just push a couple buttons, let the program do the work for me, maybe throw in some filters. That's just kind of how I am for editing. I'm more about the look of the photo, less about the post-processing. I also use my iPad a lot, so I do a lot of editing in apps like Snapseed and the default photo app there. Once again, I like to keep things simple. So I was wondering, if I was to switch over to RAW on my Canon T3i, then do all the editing in the Mac photo app and share the app from there, am I really going to notice a difference in the ripped JPEG from the RAW versus a standard JPEG photo coming right off the camera? Thanks a lot. Love the show.
Thank you so much for your question, Thomas. I really appreciate it. Now, we can get really complicated about this, but here's what it comes down to. When you shoot a JPEG, the photo that you see is processed in that camera. And even within a line of cameras from Sony or Nikon, Canon, etc., the photos could be different from camera to camera. So the photograph that you're getting out of your camera is predetermined by the engineers, usually back in Japan, who designed the software to process those. Now, I think it's important noting that even if you shoot RAW, the photo that you see on your LCD is actually a JPEG that comes from that RAW, and it's processed in the camera. So if you shoot RAW, you can kind of get a good idea for how that JPEG is going to look by looking at your LCD. Now, of course, it's not the same as looking at it on a computer, but it gives you a good idea. Now, as for how a JPEG is going to look straight out of camera, and if you see online SOOC, that's what that means, straight out of camera, the JPEG that comes out of your camera is going to look different than a JPEG that you process in Lightroom, Apple's Photos app, Aperture before that, Capture One, and any of the other RAW processors and photo editing apps that are out there. And the reason why is they have completely different code. They all process things differently. You can look at photos processed in all those apps and they will look different. So it's really hard to answer your question because yes, it will look different. Now, whether it looks better is going to depend on how you feel about it. What I would suggest doing is do a little test. Shoot RAW plus JPEG in your camera and then process those in the Photos app or whatever you want to use at the time and see how they look. You can do a straight JPEG conversion and compare that to your JPEG that's straight out of your camera and see which you prefer. Now, if you prefer that straight JPEG conversion without messing with any of the settings to the JPEG that came straight out of the camera, that's what you want to go with. And especially since you mentioned that you really don't want to do a whole lot of post-processing. And what I would suggest to people, and I always suggest this, is shooting RAW at very least, if not RAW plus JPEG. You know, it takes up a lot of space on your card. Because while you may not be into post-processing now, you may be in the future. So having those RAW files, which you can set aside on a hard drive, back them up to DVDs, whatever, and be able to process those in the future should you decide to do so, is going to be a lot better than working with the JPEG. There's a lot more data there. So while you may not want to do post-processing now, the future Thomas in, let's say, 2020, which sounds like so far away from now, doesn't it, might actually want to process his photos. And so I think in that respect, having that option available to you is good. But your question was whether or not it would look better to process a JPEG from a RAW than the JPEG that's straight out of camera. And that's really going to depend on the program and what you, as the photographer and the viewer of those photos, is into. So give it a try. Let me know what you think. Go ahead and drop me an email, lensshark@gmail.com. I'd be interested to know if you feel like the straight JPEG conversion in photos is better than the straight out of camera JPEG from your Canon. So let me know, and thank you so much for asking a question here. If you too would like to have your question answered here on the podcast, hit petapixel.com/podcast and look for our voicemail widget or give us a call at area code 206-333-9308. I'd like to thank you all for listening to episode 18 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Now, don't forget to check us out at petapixel.com/podcast for the show notes and to see what else we have for you. Now, if you'd like to connect with me personally, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook where I'm at LensShark. That's LENSSHARK. All right, with that, I'll see you all in episode 19. Well, it's f8.250 of a second outside. It's time to shoot.
Please subscribe to the Petapixel Photography Podcast. My daddy is the host.